I'm Kurt Hitchcock, and this is Footsteps. The first time I met the Lost Boys of South Sudan, who live in Lancaster, was right before a movie about the Lost Boys, The Good Lie, was released in December of 2014. I knew about their story from what I'd read and heard in the news. To hear firsthand accounts of their experience was, well, incredible. As I interviewed James McGott and Philip Dang, two of the Lost Boys who represented the group, two thoughts kept echoing in my mind. Caring and responsibility. These were linked together in the many things we discussed. It all began with caring. Caring for each other on the long marches to Ethiopia and Kenya. James McGott shares his thoughts.
Was dangerous. The river between crossing over the borders was dangerous, full infested with crocodiles, and majority of us did not know how to swim. So the river just swept off majority of us, and those memories linger in our head.
Caring for each other at the Kakuma refugee camp. Here's Philip Dang.
It was completely nothing. We just given the spot, you know, like an area for a group of 3 to 5, even to like 12, to make something, you know, to make like a hut or some sort of shelter. For the first year, people were, you know, actually struggling to build shelters. And so, but the Lost Boys of Sudan have gone through this situation in the past. And so some of them were really very creative to build, you know, nicer looking, you know, shelters.
Being cared for by loving and committed people when they finally came to America.
Well, they truly have become our family in many ways. You know, we love them dearly. We've stood by them at their weddings, and when they've lost children, we had a stillborn last September, one of them, and it's just really, they've given our lives perspective. When they arrived, their hip bones were sticking through their skin. You know, just looking at what people really come through and the resilience of the human, the capacity for resilience. Not everybody has it, but our guys really got it. And watching how grateful. I remember one time asking them, you know, didn't you get angry at God? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, no, it was God who saved us. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really an incredible statement, because just because of all they'd been through, being mm-hmm. snatched out of their little lives and from everything they knew and loved, and watching the kind of horrors that they watched, mm-hmm. and to watch them flourish now mm-hmm. is really a joy.
And continuing to care for one another today.
We back each other up. We might live in Lancaster County. It's a small city. Mm-hmm. But still, daily, day by day, we heard of who is alive, who is not, who had an accident, who is not. We talk through the phone. And one way or another, but though we might not know that individual specifically, we probably know a friend who knows that person, somebody who actually lived with that person when we were in refugee camp, somebody who came across that person and spent some time with them. And they will speak of that individual as a great person, more than a family. Randomly, we pick up the phone just to call to see how that individual doing, if we did not hear from you for a while. And if we cannot get a hold of them, we will call, I'll call Philip, or Philip will call somebody else, say, hey, did you hear from this person? What's going on? And so that the togetherness that I pray to God, and I'm hoping in the long run we will carry that on and pass it down to our children and become a different community than the community we came from.
James and Philip arrived at the Kakuma refugee camp in 1992. The camp today is home to approximately 179,000 refugees. When Philip and James first arrived, however, there was nothing. Living at a subsistence level for years, they finally received an opportunity to come to America to live. At times, though, it seemed ridiculous to even consider that they would leave the camp.
We saw people try to go to America over the years. Our teachers, doctors, who have some X amount of money, they literally go to Nairobi, Kenya all the time, selling everything they have, try to have process to come to America, but they never did. So, no, that's not going to happen. And so we just talk among ourselves, and we laugh about it, we forget about it. It wasn't like anything that we dwell on. Then years going by, and then we start having this billboard that they put to the neck to the school. Like, it's our news, it's where we find our news. Every week, the UN bring news and put it on there. And if you want to read, you go on there and read whatever that on that board. And so the first group was that they interview with the UN of coming to America. And with the interview, there is your name on it, there's a zone, it's a group, and where you're going to have interview with the UN, and where you're supposed to be coming to America. It was exciting and confused at the same time for most of us. Most of us were confused. You look around and you said, I've been with these people for years, decade, and I'm just going to get up and go to the place, strange place I heard of the names. And yeah, we know as grown up, we always see the plane back home when we were a kid. We used late, and even when in Ethiopia, we see the plane board passing in the head and, at night, and we say, that's America. Every plane flying up in the head, we used to say, that's America security, world security, like growing up as kids. And now it become a reality of us coming to America.
James was first to come to Lancaster in 2001, followed by Philip, who arrived in August, just before the attack on the World Trade Center on 9/11. Although they were not sponsored by the same churches, their experiences of being warmly welcomed parallel each other and that of other lost boys who settled in Lancaster. Philip describes his experience.
And they came to us, approached us, and greeted us with big smiles, a very, you know, friendly, you know, couple. And I was overwhelmed. And we eventually arrived at Nancy and Steve's house. And we were introduced, you know, they showed us around the house where our room was, where the bathroom was, and of course, ton of food to eat. And it was, you know, we were joy, you know, we were thankful to God that we finally made it to the U.S. The next day, I remember very well, was we got up in the morning, and Nancy had prepared, you know, breakfast for us and everything, and we were like, wow, we not used to this, you know. When we were in Kenya, we would eat, you know, twice a day. That's about it, you know. Lunch and dinner, that's it. And so breakfast, you know, this is heaven, I mean, literally. So we ate breakfast. I thought, you know, James and I thought that was our lunch, and we're like, it's too early for lunch, you know.
And hear from Nancy and her husband Steve's perspective.
We found out on a Friday that they would be arriving on a Tuesday evening at the airport, and so three others of the Lost Boys had already arrived, so we were asking, like, okay, here are the names, here are the two that are coming. Mm-hmm. And they knew James Toll, and they knew he was very tall, mm-hmm. but they didn't know who Philip was exactly, so he was a total surprise.
So it was really the luck of the draw.
It was the luck of the draw, and he actually wasn't supposed to be in our group. He was supposed to be with the Mennonite group, but the rest of the Mennonite group was delayed, and so the Mennonite said, hey, since we only have one coming, do you mind taking him until the rest of our group arrives? But we bonded so instantly that we decided we weren't giving him back. They were just, we did a lot of the back and forth. They learned British English in the refugee camps, and so, but of course they didn't practice it. And so being plunked down here in Pennsylvania, all of a sudden the learning curve was very extreme. Some of them had not been in a car before, so we were, you know, reaching over these, you know, 6-foot tall guys trying to buckle their seatbelts for them because they couldn't And they had never seen so many cars. We'd pull out onto Oregon Pike, and they're like, oh, so many cars. And we thought, wait till we take them to New York City. Everything was funny to them. We'd walk into the store, and the doors would open automatically, and they would just laugh. They thought that was hysterical. All the lessons in the kitchen about what not to put in the refrigerator, what to put in the freezer. And they'd stand there, and they'd open the freezer, then they'd open the fridge, and they'd look at me and go, Nancy, which one?
New paths of settling in the United States for the Lost Boys are never exactly the same. Some adjusted well, some did not. Some even returned to South Sudan. James was able to find a very good high-paying job soon after arriving, while Philip decided to both work and go to school at the same time.
And so by the time we came here, James and I asked, to find jobs. And so Nancy and Steve helped us with the process of the job hunting, filling out the application. Little stuff like that seem nothing to other people, but to me and to James and to all the Lost Boys of Sudan, it was a big deal. The first time I realized that my life was changing for good was when I first got my paycheck. I looked at it, I said, wow, I own paycheck for the very first time in my life. This is a huge accomplishment. And of course, everything that we have accomplished, should be credited to God. I didn't go through the hardship, the hard situation by myself. Someone helped me. I realized that the responsibilities are kicking in. Now I'm an adult. And things are changing for me. So it really depends to each Lost Boys of Sudan how to live your life here in the U.S. And so basically, we continue to get paid off like that. The time I went to college, I worked 40 hours a week and go to college full time. So I would get up early in the morning, go to school. By 2:30, my classes start at 6:30 in the morning, and my last class was at 2:30 in the afternoon, and so I would leave school, go straight to work, and work from 3 to 11, and then go home, shower, eat, do a little bit of studying, and then go to sleep, sleeping between 2 to 3 hours. For that duration of my college years. And so 4 years later, I got my bachelor's degree, and I realized that I was the first person in my family to get the college degree. So that was a huge accomplishment.
Yet like all the Lost Boys, their hearts remain with the people they left behind in South Sudan. Pastor Randy Jenkins, whose church sponsored James, and James himself describe how money was prioritized after they first came and started working.
From the very beginning, when they first started getting jobs, they would do everything they could, and we made them after 6 months, we made them start paying rent, and started acclimating them to, this is what you have to do, and if you're going to be on your own. And they would bring their check in, and sometimes they'd come and say, well, they didn't have any money left for rent, and I'd say, well, where did the money go? Mm-hmm. Well, I sent it home. That's a common thread. Every time they got enough money that they could send a check, back to Kenya, they sent it, and they would work extra hours and everything else to be able to send more money home. And it was hard to say to them, no, you can't do that. You've got to keep enough money to keep yourself here, right, so that later you can be able to send more money. But they struggled with that really hard in the beginning. It was, well, I know my mother needs food.
When we first came here, like, my first job, I started at over $11 an hour. It's not like the rest of the refugees coming today. That's barrel. And so we were making good money, American ways back then, and it still is now. And those money, by the end of the month, we make, what, 1,300 or more. But by the end of the month, you look, you make this a lot of money by the end of the month. But now it's time to pay rent, it's time to pay phone, it's time to pay cell phone, it's time to pay electric, it's all these bills. But at the same time, you have relatives here who have nothing. And they're also calling you nonstop. This person is sick. We have nothing to eat. This child is sick. This person got shot. This person is this. We needed treatment. You're the only one who can do it. You're in America. And so you're sitting there like, okay, which one is the best to do? Saving a person who's dying or paying the bills?
Caring for each other is evidenced by the Lost Boys of Lancaster's commitment to get together twice a month for fellowship. It includes a custom Pastor Randy Jenkins found both different and interesting.
They compete to see who can jump the highest, but they're all laughing and you know, having a good time. And it amazes me how, from a standing still, how high they can jump. And they get to jumping up and down, and you get 20 of them out there jumping and going. And it's a competition, really, right, for them. Right. And for me, it's just a waste of good muscle, you know.
Looking back, it's hard to believe how far James, Philip, and most of the other Lost Boys have come since arriving in Lancaster 13 years ago. James is married and the father of three children with a good job in a highly technical area. Philip is also married. He and his wife have two children and he works as a social worker. They are both men of tremendous faith and gratitude for the help and care that they've received. Philip has a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to rebuild the lives of those that have been affected by civil war and conflict. He and James will be going to Uganda this summer to provide clothing and other basic necessities to refugees that have fled from South Sudan. As he told me about his last trip to Uganda, I knew where the echo of caring and responsibility was coming from. It was in the DNA of the Lost Boys of South Sudan.
The living condition at those refugee camps in Uganda, it is nothing compared to Kakuma refugee camp where James and I were 13 years ago. And that is, you know, people, for us, for me and James, it was just us. You know, there were no children involved. Well, we were children. But there were no, you know, women involved in that situation. So as I was walking, you know, just touring the resettlement camps and refugee camps in northern Uganda, seeing, you know, just, you know, children and women just laying under the trees, you know, helplessly. And so before I went to Uganda, I had raised nearly $2,500. And so I promised, you know, I pray to God that this money will go to those who do not have, you know, the help. My family members do have help. You know, my wife and I help them. But there are thousands of other families out there who do not have people here in the U.S. to help them. And so that $2,500 went through buying, you know, the medical you know, like medications, over-the-counter medications, And because the kids and women, you know, even the men, they don't have anything. They just left with whatever they had at a time.